Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right, from Live Science. Apparently, millions of mystery holes at the bottom of the North Sea are not what scientists thought they were.
Ooh.
Hmm.
So, in the murky waters of the North Sea, there are these shallow divots that dot the seafloor. And there's a picture if you want to look at it, but they range in width from a few meters to more than 196 feet. But they're only about 4.3 inches deep. They're very shallow.
Huh.
Some pits appear to have merged, which create these oblong Venn diagram-shaped depressions. And usually we see these pits when fluids containing methane bubble out of the sediment. But new research, published in Communications, Earth and Environment, suggests that thousands and perhaps millions of pits in the North Sea and elsewhere might actually be the work of foraging porpoises.
Wow.
Now, for years, geoscientist Jens Schneider von Daimling of Kiel University was skeptical that the North Sea pits were due to leaking methane. The floor of the North Sea is made of porous sand. It has these strong currents. Neither of those are conducive to methane accumulating in sediment.
Hmm.
So out on the water during a research cruise, he and his colleagues confirmed his suspicion. Mapping studies designed to detect methane in the sediment using a sub-bottom echo sounder, which is a kind of sonar that bounces sound off the seafloor to image the shallow subsurface, turned up nothing. Quote, "We mined thousands of miles of data for shallow gas and simply didn't find that." So to get a better look at the pits, they used even fancier tech, something called a multi-beam echo sounder. And the pits were not, in fact, conical, which would be the case if a narrow stream of methane burst through the sediment. What makes them exceptional is that the depth doesn't change with the aspect ratio, which is kind of wonky, right?
Mm.
Like, regardless of how wide they are, the pits are still just 4.3 inches deep. Well, Schneider von Daimling called up diver friend, biologist buddy, who told him about how the harbor porpoise scours the seafloor sniffing for sand eels.
That's just like the exact depth of a porpoise's nose is 4.3 inches.
Yep, that's exactly right. So after that call, Schneider teamed up with the biologists studying porpoises, and they used existing models to predict the habitats of eels and porpoises and overlaid oceanographic data of currents. And they found that the habitats overlapped with their study area. So back on the water with the echo sounder, the researchers found that wherever they had expected to find porpoises and sand eels, they found more pits. And the bigger pits, according to the researchers, are porpoise pits that had been scoured by ocean currents. They poke their nose in the sand and the water kind of makes that hole a little wider, but no deeper, right?
Hmm.
So they hope someday to get photographic proof of a porpoise digging a pit, which is, you know, a video.
They don't have that yet. Okay.
We don't, but I mean, I can only imagine it's like a dolphin just going schmork, putting his nose right in the sand.
I mean, I think we're going to find out that, it's the porpoises doing it, but like they're making art. Like this is a whole communal thing.
<right. they're>
like...
That said, the researchers are, they're not holding their breath, right? Part of it is because the North Sea waters are really murky, so it's hard to see much. And the harbor porpoise, kind of shy. So for now, the researchers are working with scientists in Ireland to confirm that their predictions of pit locations based on porpoise habitat apply to areas outside the North Sea. This just goes to show how interdisciplinary studies like this are a way for geoscientists to help biologists learn more about animal behavior and vice versa.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated how many times in this podcast we get articles where it's like, This guy was trying to solve a problem, and he randomly called up someone in an entirely different field, and the person in the other field is like, oh yeah, duh, we know that. And like, it's just a question of talking to each other.
Yes, everything, everywhere, all at once, it's all connected. Mm-hmm. But for now, at least, we have figured out porpoise snout holes on the seafloor.
Well, that's much better than methane holes.
Yeah, honestly, like, this is a good outcome all around.
Yeah, good news. All right, next link.
Next link. This article comes to us from Cosmos Magazine, and it's titled Glitter Banned by EU with Calls for Australia to Follow.
Wow.
Yay. Oh my gosh. End of an era.
Around the world, it elevates fashion, makeup, crafts, and performance, but it is a microplastic, which is small plastic pieces less than 5 millimeters long that's usually coated in a thin layer of metal. Like other microplastics, glitter ends up in waterways and oceans, posing detrimental threats to aquatic ecosystems. A recent study of the Brazilian water weed Garia densa, published in New Zealand Journal of Botany, has found that the metal coating on glitter impairs aquatic plant growth. This coating hinders the underwater passage of light and hence significantly reduces the photosynthetic rates of the plant.
Huh.
So, Professor Irinu Bianchini Jr., a co-author of the article from the Federal University of São Carlos, said in a media release, it's important to warn society that changes in photosynthesis rates are linked to other changes that affect us more directly, such as the decrease in primary food production in aquatic environments at the bottom of the food chain. The environmental issues relating to glitter encouraged Associate Professor Ipek Kurtbok at the University of Sunshine Coast to call for a ban on glitter. She said, there is overwhelming evidence on the threat it poses to aquatic life through ingestion, contact with its toxic ingredients, and physical injury. Unfortunately, her research suggests that even bioglitter made from biodegradable compounds isn't safe for marine ecosystems. Apparently, it can't easily be removed, although it doesn't appear to pose a threat to industrial sewage systems. Camilla Warner, media coordinator for SA Water, told Cosmos, our treatment plans are designed to remove general debris, including glitter, from our treated water, but we've never experienced a glitter challenge before. So, I mean, that's nice. There's no glitter in our water.
A glitter challenge. Like, what does that look like? Someone dumping a barrel in there to see what happens?
I guess the glitter challenge would be, can you use glitter without getting it everywhere?
And that's no, you can't. Well, and there's another thing. Glitter can actually be used for corporate sabotage.
What?
Like, because it's metal, if it gets into computer intake fans, it can just ruin them. And I literally know of a case where a guy was in a shared data center with a bunch of other companies, and he would basically take a little Ziploc baggie of glitter under his arm. And when he walked by the competitor's computers, he would just sort of squeeze it and let a little puff of glitter out, and it would get sucked into their machines.
No.
And their machines would fail. And so they were having all these failures, and it was ultimately they caught him on camera, and he like went to jail. Like, it was sabotage. It was damage of property.
Yeah, but like, I mean, glitter do a lot. Glitter is going to absolutely show up on CCTV, right? It's going to pick up light like crazy.
Yeah. No, they definitely caught him as soon as they started looking.
Wow.
But it was like, honestly, I was like, respect, because that is such a clever way of just casually walking by and ruining someone's multi-million dollar server.
And also, too, I mean, glitter has been banned by burners for quite some time, like Burning Man. No glitter is allowed because it gets everywhere and they know they can't pick it up. So hippies have known for a while. No glitter.
Always got to look to the hippies for the best advice.
That's right.
Ooh, I don't know about that, y'all.
Next link.
Let's stay in the water. From the BBC, gills allowed? Tiny fish found making very big noise.
That's a UK pun, right? For girls allowed? Okay.
Didn't even get it.
Yes.
Okay.
So a tiny transparent fish makes a sound as loud as a pneumatic drill.
What?
Scientists in Berlin have discovered. What actually prompted them to investigate was hearing mysterious clicking noises coming from the fish tanks in their lab. They found that the fish Danionella cerebrum drums out a powerful rhythm on an organ called a swim bladder. In the waters close to the fish, it taps out 140 decibels, which is as loud as a gunshot.
Whoa.
And for those that don't know, 140 dB is the upper threshold of pain. You push more than 140, you're probably going to have permanent ear damage.
Wow.
So don't stick your ear in the tank while these are going off.
Yeah.
Researchers believe that this 12 millimeter or half an inch for Americans long species is the loudest fish for its size yet found. Scientists have known that other creatures, such as the aptly named pistol shrimp, can create very loud noises as they hunt for other species. Did we do? I could have sworn we did a podcast on the pistol shrimp.
Maybe. It would be a great band name.
Yeah, what a pejorative, you pistol shrimp.
Right. Yeah, that does sound like a great slur, you pistol shrimp.
So good on the tongue, y'all.
Yeah.
So Danionella is valued by science because it's transparent, which means you can see its brains in action. Mm. And this allows researchers to closely study its behavior. But while working with these fish in their lab in Germany, the scientists noticed something odd. Verity Cook said, people were just walking past the fish tanks and they could hear these sounds and were wondering, where are they coming from? Using an array of mics and video cameras, the research team were soon able to work out just how loud. At a distance of one body length, around 140 dB is the amplitude of the sound.
Wow. Jeez.
Sound attenuates with distance. So at about 1 meter or 3 feet to us, the amplitude is around 108 dB, which is equivalent of a bulldozer. You can yell at about 108, 110. So it's yelling underwater still at about 3 feet away.
So we could go in there and yell back at them. It could be like an argument.
But just wait, there's more. Much of this sound is reflected back into the water. So when the humans stand beside the fish tanks, they hear the pulses as continuous buzzing sound.
Oh.
Which means for the fish, it's just bouncing around there, like shooting a gun off in a bathroom.
Wow. This is like a Jordan Peele situation for fish.
Right.
Apparently, only the males of the species make the sound, and only when they do it in company.
Oh, it's like, what's up, bro?
Exactly. Totally bro. Yeah,
I've been to a bar.
Yeah.
Some men are just loud. And when you have maybe like eight males together in a large tank, three of them will dominate the sound production and the others will just be quiet. Mm, so they're all just politicians.
Right. It's like going into any conference call or meeting.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Three people dominate and everybody else just shuts up. They think there's some sort of hierarchy, but they don't know.
I really love thinking about a sterile, fishy science lab environment, and suddenly everybody starts going insane because there are these clicking sounds no one can identify.
Yeah,
and I was thinking of like Charlie Day from It's Always Sunny, like furiously putting mics and video cameras everywhere. I mean, like, I gotta find the sound. I gotta find the sound.
Right, it's a good thing that it happened in a science lab.
Right.
Next link.
All right. Well, it is not intentional, but we are staying in the water. This next one comes from the B1M, and it's called The $1 Billion Plan to Fix Paris's Dirty Secret.
Oh, the B1M, they do architectural stuff.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes. So it's an interesting overlap of ecology and architecture here. And, you know, I'm sure Paris has a lot of dirty secrets, but the one they're referring to has to do with the 2024 Olympic Games, which will be held in the City of Love. One of the big things that the Parisian mayor's office has been advertising in the run-up to the games this year is that all of the swimming events will be held not in everyone's favorite measurement, the Olympic-sized swimming pool, but directly in the Seine River.
Oh, dear.
Yes. The problem with this, of course, is that the Seine River is incredibly polluted, to the point that swimming in it is actually illegal and will get you a 15-euro fine.
Oh, no.
That's great.
These are athletes who usually take exceptional care of their health.
And Paris is like, get in the water.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, over the last several years, Paris has embarked on a $1 billion plan to clean up the Seine, and they have been making admirable progress. Supposedly, as of 2022, they had removed 90% of the construction debris, metal appliances, various cars lurking at the bottom, amounting to about 360 tons of material.
But how many bodies?
Yeah, they didn't talk about that. I'm sure there
material,
were a lot.
Bradley, yeah, material, Bradley,
yeah.
Material.
Construction material. Got it.
Right. Unfortunately, the remaining 10% equals they still have about 40 tons left to go. And that's proving to be more stubborn because eventually you reach a stasis point where people are still illegally dumping stuff into the river, even as you remove it. But, you know, to be honest, the river is deep and no one's really that worried about swimmers scraping their legs on submerged rebar. The real problem is, true story.
Dysentery.
Yeah, it's not the, like, torturous shrapnel that they need to navigate. It's...
No, the real problem is the chemical and sewage runoff. which measures around 1.9 million cubic meters at any given time. And unfortunately, there isn't a whole lot they can do about the sewage, and more specifically, the fecal bacteria, because the Paris sewer system was never meant to handle the 11 million people who now live on top of it. And every time it rains, they have to voluntarily release a certain amount of sewage into the river, or else the pipes will get flooded and presumably begin spewing upward into people's homes.
Oh, the smell of rain in Paris.
Exactly.
It's quite different. It's different.
Yeah, yeah. Petrichor, is that what that's called? Yeah.
Poopricor.
Poopricor. There you go. So there are good days and bad days when it comes to the amount of E. coli in the Seine River. And one of the semi-effective solutions that France has come up with is to sort of wall off these open-air swimming pools along the banks of the river, which are fed by river water but are on their own filtration and treatment system, so at least a part of the water can be considered clean enough to swim in. And they've actually got some of these pools working on the very edges of the city, which aren't meant to be used for the Olympics but are sort of a proof of concept that will theoretically inspire the construction of 26 more pools just like them in central Paris.
But the water doesn't stay localized. Even if you clean this part of the water, it's going to mix with the dirty water.
Right. Well, and the whole idea was like, oh, okay, we'll put these Olympians in these little isolated pools. But it feels like the schedule has gotten pushed back. Because while it does seem like these 26 pools were originally being promised for the Olympic Games, they're now merely being talked about in terms of leisure activities for Paris residents starting in 2025. Yeah. So, you know, it may still happen someday, but the Olympians will definitely still be swimming directly in the river.
No.
Oh, yes. City officials have already had to cancel or postpone some training and certifying events for the Olympics because the bacterial levels were too high on the day.
Wait, they're going forward with this? They're not just going to be like, let's use this high school pool because
it's not Olympic sized. What are you going to do? Like, they've had this plan and they're sticking to it. The head of competitions, Brigitte Legeret, says there is no plan B. Like, everybody keeps asking them, but what are you going to do?
Wow.
And they're like, this is what we're doing. We're not acknowledging.
Here, it's the Maginot Line or nothing else.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? We're going to double down.
Oh. Yeah. And, you know, that's just the poop. What about the chemicals? Well, again, they've reached a point of stasis where they're no longer removing built-up old chemicals, but rather trying to deal with the influx of new chemicals that get washed into the river from the streets every time it rains. So in order to deal with that, the city has constructed a massive drainage cistern at Austerlitz Station. And this is where we get into the architecture construction bit of it, which will ideally redirect and capture the majority of urban runoff and allow it to be treated before it is ultimately dumped into the Seine.
Well, that's good. That's good. Zoom out on that enough. Whether what it's for or not, the end result would be good, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, and cleaning up that water is useful. And the article is unclear over whether it is operational yet or not. But the cistern is 34 meters wide and 50 meters deep. Which is, as the article notes, the volume of 20 Olympic swimming pools, which makes me wonder why they didn't just build the pools in the first place. Like, I get that it goes deep. It's not the same as a bunch of pools at ground level. But I feel like maybe they could have done like a parking garage situation, you know? Like,
certainly would have cost way less.
Probably.
I get the impulse, which is to host Olympic Games. Usually there is so much bloat because of the new construction that has to happen. So the impulse of, well, instead of creating something new, let's restore something that we have. But their project manager was sleeping on the job because the order of operations on this was completely jacked up. Like, you have to address the human behavior to stop the flow first so you have a known amount to clean up and then just fix that. But
the human behavior part. Yeah, to make everybody stop using chemicals at ground level is not going to happen. You know, you'd have to basically get rid of all the cars. I mean, there's some changes.
I find it really hard to believe Michael Phelps is going to be like, yeah, I'm game to go into that water. Like,
he smokes weed. He's fine.
They mentioned that another way to measure the cistern is that it is nearly as deep as the Statue of Liberty is tall, which is clearly a little reminder from them of who gave us that statue in the first place. But of course, the hope is that with less runoff going into the sewer systems, they won't have to put as much raw sewage into the river as often either. It's a good thing.
Right.
And, you know, regardless of whether they get everything working properly in time for the Olympics, other cities are taking notice of this feat that they have pulled off. Both Amsterdam and Berlin have begun similar cleanup efforts in their own rivers based on the Paris project. And water and sanitation officials from Los Angeles, which will be hosting the 2028 Games, have visited the project in Paris to see what they can potentially learn. So, you know, it's worth it in the end. And this is clearly going to be us laughing at ourselves by 2028 because Los Angeles is not clean either. I mean, I'm imagining disaster. Like, they're going to be like, okay, it's time for the freestyle. Oh, you can't. The water's poopy. And that's it. Like, you just canceled. What are we going to do?
So. Right. Or one of the swimmers is going to get dysentery.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Nice. Next link.
Next link. Okay, from MIT Technology Review. Sorry to say, guys, but the era of cheap helium is over. And yeah, that's already causing some problems. So if you didn't already know, helium is critical to all kinds of technologies like MRI scanners and even semiconductors. Huh. But the thing is, it's only produced in a few places. So in a way, it's good news. We could produce helium for...
Yeah, we still got it, but...
Yeah, like, for years, you know, we've been warning about this dwindling helium supply. And because of that, I had always sort of assumed, like, it was just a finite natural resource. But in the Nuclear Magnetic Resonance Facility at Mississippi State University, three powerful magnets make it possible to see how atoms form bonds. The chemists there use the technology to design new polymers and study how bacteria binds to surfaces. So every 12 weeks, the university pays $5,000 to $6,000 to replenish the liquid helium required to cool the superconducting wire coiled up inside the magnets down to -269 Celsius. In Fahrenheit, that's -452. Quote, it's by far the biggest expense we have, and that has pretty much doubled over the past year or so.
Wow.
Now, helium is excellent at conducting heat, and at temperatures close to absolute zero, which is where most other materials freeze solid, helium stays liquid. That's why it's essential to any technology that uses superconducting magnets, including MRIs, particle accelerators, quantum computers, even the infrared detectors on the James Webb Space Telescope. And as a gas, helium whisks heat away from silicon to prevent damage in semiconductor fabs. So it's a critical element for the future. Indeed, the European Union includes helium on its 2023 list of critical raw materials, and even Canada put it on a critical minerals list too. And the history of this has been kind of weird. So at times, countries have taken extreme measures to secure a steady helium supply. Let's see, in 1975, an issue of MIT Technology Review focused on a Westinghouse engineer named H. Richard Howland, who wrote about a controversial U.S. program that stockpiled helium for decades. And even today, helium is not always easy to get. The world's supply depends primarily on three countries, the U.S., Qatar, and Algeria. And fewer than 15 companies worldwide.
Wow.
With so few sources, the helium market is particularly sensitive to disruptions. Let's say a plant goes offline or, I don't know, war breaks out. Suddenly.
Guitar, right.
Right, yeah. And as Fitzky noted, the price of helium has climbed rapidly in recent years, which is putting hospitals and research groups in a real pinch. So some research labs, including Fitzky's, are now installing recycling systems for helium, and MRI manufacturers are making next-gen scanners that require less of it. And it's not just hospitals, right? Other industries are finding ways around helium, too. For example, welders have substituted argon or hydrogen on some jobs, while chemists have switched to hydrogen for gas chromatography. So overall, the helium industry expects to see a lot of growth in the low single digits over the next few years. Guess they had to throw in that sentence for the armchair investors.
I say, can I buy the stock?
Well, yeah, I have a half a tank of helium left over from a birthday party. What do you think that gets me on the black market? Like, does I hold on to that? Is that an asset?
Don't put it on, don't let it go on Facebook Marketplace. You need to go the Silk Road with that business.
Right, right.
All those balloon manufacturers. Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, if we can switch to hydrogen for our balloons, I'm sure that won't have any negative problems at the child's birthday party. Hindenburg's for everyone. Come on. Like,
humanity. All right. Next link.
Next link. So we're going to return to France for this one.
Ooh.
This article is from messynessychic.com, and the title asks a question. How does a 10-day week sound?
Good.
10-day vacation week? It's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the French tried it for 13 years. So if a wine's vintage is decided by the year the grapes were harvested, wouldn't it be fitting for France to celebrate the new year at harvest time? At the turn of the 19th century, that's just what France did. With the rise of the First Republic in the wake of the French Revolution, France was free of a monarchy for the first time, meaning the new government had an unprecedented opportunity to mold an entirely new society. Hmm. The birth of Jesus defined year one during the ancient regime, but the birth of the new republic called for a fresh start and a new year one. The first month of this new year would be called Vendémiaire, the Occitan word for grape harvest. Poet slash playwright slash politician Fabre d'Églantine had named all the new months to reflect France's climate and agrarian cycle. He was part of a government-sponsored commission of savants, or wise ones, mathematicians, astronomers, geographers, and horticulturalists dedicated to reinventing how France kept time. Another government-appointed commission had a parallel undertaking to give France a standard unit of weights and measures. Centuries of feudalism had crumbled Roman standardization into about 800 regional measurement systems across the country. Wow. According to the National Geographic, in early 18th century Bordeaux, a unit of land was defined by how far a man's voice carried. But this wouldn't do for an enlightened nation. Under the leadership of philosopher and mathematician the Marquis de Condorcet, the commission was hard at work developing the metric system. In keeping with the metric commission's effort, the calendar commission fixated on multiples of 10. They retained 12 months in a year, but broke each month into three 10-day weeks. The downside of the 10-day week was that workers didn't get a day off until the 10th day. Mm-hmm. So, not so great. Relatedly, and keeping in mind that the French revolutionaries and the church were not exactly on good terms, Christmas became an anti-saint day in honor of Isaac Newton, conveniently born on that day.
Yeah.
So the devotion to reason was clearly more theoretical than practical, and the 10-day week seemed to contradict the Republic's reason of elevating the masses. In fact, the calendar's structure was very much like that of ancient Egypt, a slave-based civilization. But they didn't stop at decimalizing the calendar, they also decimalized the clock. The day was divided into just 10 hours, an hour consisted of 100 minutes, and a minute consisted of 100 seconds. Again, elegant in theory, tiresome in life. Clockmakers produced a bevy of new timepieces with both 12 and 10-hour dials, as well as both Gregorian and Republican calendar dials to help people adjust.
Wow.
In March 1794, metric system champion the Marquis de Condorcet died in jail, and our month-naming friend Fabre d'Églantine met the guillotine. In June 1795, death came for the chairman of the calendar committee, mathematician-turned-politician Charles Gilbert Rome. But Rome's calendar and decimal time remained in use until Emperor Napoleon I abolished them in 1806.
Wow. It's a long time to have it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I feel like I would just give up the first month, however long that is.
Right.
30 days, I guess. Fair play. But just as the National Convention government had conceived of a new calendar as a way to break with the ancient regime, Napoleon didn't want his empire associated with the revolution. However, he wasn't interested in creating yet another calendar. He returned France to the Gregorian calendar and the 24-hour day. He still had the metric system to deal with, which he described as tormenting the people with trivia, according to National Geographic.
Wow, it's like me at a party.
Yeah. So, in March 1871, nearly 80 years after the birth of the First Republic and its calendar, there was another revolution, this time proletariat rebels seized Paris and established a democratic socialist government. For 18 days in May, the Paris Commune brought back the Republican calendar, aligning themselves with the spirit of the revolution. But they did not last till June. The Paris Commune was an inspiration to the Bolsheviks during the Russian Revolution, but the Bolsheviks ultimately decided against the French Republican system, instead asserting Soviet Russia's modernity by joining Europe in the Gregorian system.
Hmm.
After the Paris Commune, the French Republican calendar was never adopted again, but buildings from the First Republic can still be spotted with their odd dates. A fountain in Octon-Hirol in the south of France, for instance, bears a plaque reading, Republic Francois, 5 Ventos on 109, that is February 24th, 1901. So the article goes on for more about the many different cultural clues we still have to this old calendar system. There's a bunch more art in here, but I don't want to take all the time on pointless trivia, as Napoleon would put it.
All right, well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include why the Eye of the Sahara is a geological mystery, how the Village Voice met its moment, and the quest for the highest stakes hold music of all time. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on damninteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/damninterestingweek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Waisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.